welcome to another edition of The Peace Production, the podcast from the Organization for World Peace, where we examine current issues threatening human security. My name is Catherine Everest, and joining me today is Monica Sager, our in-house correspondent. Good morning, Monica.
Hi, Kate.
Today, we talk with Paul Lachelier, founder and director of Learning Life. Learning Life was established in 2012 and champions themselves as a lab for innovative learning and projects, intended to nurture learning and citizen engagement in everyday life for individuals across the world. In 2016, they began their flagship program, the Family Diplomacy Initiative, which hopes to bring a greater focus to the needs, challenges, joys, hopes, and mutual understanding of families worldwide into international affairs. We had a look through the website of Learning Life, and some of the participant feedback on their programs was just very positive and heartwarming. So a participant from Dakar in Senegal said, "Through Learning Life, we explore our cultures. Through the photos, we see diverse views. We look back on the past, improve the present, and offer perspectives about the future. Learning Life allows us to discover other cultures, to travel without leaving our country, and to improve communication during our dialogues." To learn more, let's hear from Paul. Welcome, Paul. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Paul, could you start by sharing with our audience a little bit of background on Learning Life, why education and diplomacy?
Learning Life is basically a lab for innovating education and citizen engagement outside school walls. And I started as a sociologist in 2012. After having been in academia for many years and coming to recognize that a lot of inequality is produced outside school walls, particularly in families and communities, and that there is relatively little attention paid to inequalities in everyday life outside school walls, that when it comes to education, the overwhelming focus is on schools, and there's far less concern for what happens in families and communities. And yet we know as sociologists that a lot of inequality is generated in families and communities. So our intent is to try to create programs, oftentimes free programs, that are intended to nurture education and opportunity in everyday life outside school walls.
And so I guess when you say that you want to focus on inequalities that are outside school walls, you say on your website that you want to provide an education for kids that is sort of more self-directed and allows them to learn alternative material than their usual school material. So do you feel that school curricula around the world sort of lacks a degree of internationalism and an emphasis on inequality and global citizenship and things like that?
Yes and no. I mean, I think there's growing trend towards kind of international education schools. The question is whether or not we're grappling effectively enough with rising inequality in the world. There are some kids at one end of the scale who get extraordinary education. So for instance, here in the Washington, D.C. area, there's a new school that's been developed that has a campus in China and a campus here in the United States, and the kids get to shuttle back and forth between the two campuses called the Whittle School. Great for those who can afford it, but at the opposite end of the scale, and it's an explicitly global education, obviously, right? Because they have two campuses and they intend to expand to other campuses in the world. And at the other end of the scale are kids who get practically nothing. And so our approach follows a connected learning approach, which tries to tap free resources like the internet, mentors, volunteers more generally, to create opportunities for kids to learn that's interest-based. So in that sense, so interest-based means that that's the sense in which it's somewhat self-directed. It's you have to create the right kind of conditions for them to be excited about learning. And that means embedding them in some sort of a community of peers, of mentors, et cetera, and also drive or have the education based on what they're interested in. So, you know, with our mentoring program, for instance, we had a girl from El Salvador, from a lower-income family, from the capital in San Salvador, who's interested in music and dance. So our mentor connects those interests to the wider world because, of course, music and dance are eminently international. That's an example of what we do.
So then looking at the broader picture, it's a common saying that the education system is broken. In what ways do you think that this is true, and how does Learning Life then repair that?
I would not go so far as to say that our educational system is broken. I think what's fairer to say is that it's inadequate. And it's inadequate, particularly in dealing with inequality. And I think part of the problem is to the extent that we try to monetize education. So the Whittle School is monetizing education. They are finding, you know, there are no lack of people in the upper 20%, I guess, of incomes worldwide who are doing really well. And those people want the best for their kids. And oftentimes that means private education, which cordons off their kids in these islands of privilege. And of course, those schools try to make themselves feel better by recruiting a few kids from lower income backgrounds. But essentially, they're reproducing in doing so by cordoning off the privileged. They tend to reinforce inequalities and privilege in the world. So I think that to me is the way in which education, I guess, is dysfunctional. But besides inequalities, there's this issue that we, meaning the world, increasingly are a lot better at producing consumers than we are citizens. And that's kind of a central concern for Learning Life. And by consumers, I mean people who are avid consumers of all kinds of commercial products and services, but who know relatively little about how the world works and how they can influence the world to make it a better place. And at the opposite, a citizen is somebody who ideally knows at least some, if not a lot, about how the world works and how to make the world a better place, and knows less about, you know, the latest who's dating who in Hollywood and what's the latest show, et cetera, and so forth. And if you watch and listen to kids, at least here in the United States, and I think this is true elsewhere, they're far better consumers than they are citizens. And I think that's a problem that is largely produced outside school walls when kids leave schools and head back to their homes and their communities.
Definitely. Another problem facing all of us right now is obviously the COVID-19. Do you think the pandemic has an effect on the education system? And is Learning Life's belief of learning outside of the classroom going to be a benefit in relation to the pandemic?
So COVID is aggravating inequalities because schools that have more resources are better equipped to deal with this transition from in-person to online learning. So it is a concern of ours. We have three programs: the Family Diplomacy Initiative, an international mentoring program, and the Democracy Dinners. Those programs are, fortunately, the Family Diplomacy Initiative and the international mentoring program are both, we're able to varying extents to transition them online. So the international mentoring program, most of our mentors have been able to transition to just what we're calling distance mentoring. But the Family Diplomacy Initiative has always been an online endeavor, connecting families across borders. That hasn't been affected as much, but the mentoring program has. And we've developed some models that seem to work well for mentoring our kids from afar. You know, nothing substitutes for in-person learning. So that's kind of some of the challenge.
And so I guess the next question probably sort of relates to what you were talking about in terms of the inequalities that can be bred in education and outside of school walls and things like that. So part of Learning Life's mission is to nurture caring, connected, skilled and informed global citizens across all ages. Why do you feel it's important to nurture these qualities in global citizens and particularly in school age children?
We live in an increasingly connected, or you might say intertwined world. And to me, the difference between connected and intertwined is connected, you presumably know the ways in which we're connected, and intertwined, you don't. And so that's, I think, part of the problem. There's an American philosopher, Michael Sandel, who said that, you know, the modern condition is in essence, in a phrase, that we're intertwined yet detached, and that is to say we're bound with each other and yet we don't know each other. And that's problematic for a variety of reasons. You know, the shirt I wear was perhaps made in Bangladesh in a sweatshop that ends up collapsing because of poor working conditions and building codes. And I know absolutely nothing about it. And yet I've contributed in some small way to that, or the ways in which, you know, are the variety of other products we buy, from chocolate to diamonds to t-shirts, are implicated in a complex world system. So to the extent that global citizens, first of all, care, and then secondly, want to engage with the world to better understand things and to figure out how we can make the world a better place for everybody rather than a place where some thrive and some suffer, or in a lot of people suffer, that I think is fundamentally the purpose of being a global citizen, is to try to make the wider world a better place in our intertwined yet detached condition.
Your flagship program is the Family Diplomacy Initiative. I guess, firstly, how would you define diplomacy?
Diplomacy is I would define generally as the management of international relations. That has for a long time been the task of a relatively small number of people, aristocrats then professionals, essentially. And so we are, in essence, trying to change that.
Keeping in line with that, how does the Family Diplomacy Initiative work?
In essence, the Family Diplomacy Initiative is devoted to connecting families across borders. And that's not just borders, national borders, but also across lines of race or ethnicity and class. So we are interested in developing family diplomacy as a new form of citizen diplomacy because, first of all, families are widely valued across the world. And secondly, they're deeply impacted by international affairs, whether it's refugee crises, climate change, terrorism, or else, or disease. And yet they're poorly represented in international affairs in a formal sense. So thankfully, organizations like the United Nations are increasingly interested in representing youth and women, but the family itself as an institution hasn't, as far as we know, been particularly well represented. And there are good reasons for the reasons that I mentioned. One is that they're widely valued across the world. Two is that they're deeply impacted, but also because at their best, families, and that's an important kind of caveat, at their best, families are a caring institution and a model for caring in the world that needs to be recognized and elevated. So our purpose is to bring attention to the diversity of families that exist in the world, at least initially, to have to connect them through Facebook so that they can talk together and share with each other and learn together. And ultimately to make the case for including families in the wider world, in international governance.
And I guess by targeting the family, then you can target all ages and stages of life. And yeah, it really encapsulates a little bit more than traditional diplomacy, as you say.
Yeah, exactly. And that, to some extent, kind of humanizes diplomacy. It brings it with it the recognition that, you know, family life isn't easy. Family life is fraught. It's first and foremost kind of an emotional experience, and it's literally the basis of life for human beings. And so, to the extent that we bring the needs, the fears, the aspirations of families to the fore, that includes, among other things, the needs of kids and women, which tend to be oftentimes are suppressed, then I think we humanize not just diplomacy, but international affairs. And that's all the more important in a world that needs a hell of a lot more caring and a lot less conflict.
So almost along those lines, as well as the Family Diplomacy Initiative, Learning Life runs an international mentoring program. How does this work?
Our Family Diplomacy Initiative was started in 2016. In November 2015, the terrorist attacks happened in Paris, which prompted us to think about how we could contribute meaningfully to the development of something innovative in the kind of education citizen engagement that wasn't the typical and the growing proportion of organizations that are doing student-to-student and classroom-to-classroom engagement across borders. And so what we came up with is a family diplomacy initiative or family-to-family dialogue. At the time, we started kind of informally mentoring some of the kids that we were working with. These are kids that are all, at the time, all lower income, all African-American kids in actually Southeast DC in Ward 8, which is the poorest ward of Washington, DC. And we found that the kids that we were informally mentoring were exhibited more self-confidence and seemed to be more interested in our program when they knew they had some sort of an informal mentor. And so that prompted the development of our international mentoring program in 2018. And so the international mentoring program, in essence, is devoted to helping to open the world to kids from lower income backgrounds. So, you know, when we started the Family Diplomacy Initiative, my thought was, well, if you just put kids in front of the computer and you have them talk to each other, or you have them talk to somebody live in some other part of the world, they'll be fascinated and glued to it, and they won't want to stop talking. And it's not at all the case. They'd rather be playing their video games, or they'd rather be playing outside with their friends than talking to some strangers on the screen that they know absolutely nothing about. So that was a kind of lesson learned. And so our response to that was to try to create caring relationships between an adult and, who wants to help a young child and children who oftentimes don't get nearly as much one-on-one attention as they need. So that's the purpose of the mentoring program. It's twofold: to creating a caring relationship with somebody who's not part of their family, but also to help open the world to them by taking the kids out to, when we do it in person, taking them out to here in DC, embassies, cultural festivals, foreign restaurants, museums, libraries, et cetera, with an eye towards drawing on their interests and connecting those interests to the wider world.
So I think you sort of answered this a little bit prior, but when you said that obviously diplomacy has sort of being in the hands of professionals and aristocrats and that sort of thing. But I'll ask it just in case you have any other thoughts as well. The current international diplomacy system in place today sees countries assign professional diplomatic representatives from governments to negotiate with other countries. So in creating the Family Diplomacy Initiative, do you believe there are shortcomings in the current international diplomacy system that is in place today? And if so, what examples can you give us?
Yeah, so I've written a couple of pieces. One on if you look up Paul Lashley, Democratized Diplomacy, I talk about some of the problems, a strictly professional system. The interesting thing is, if you talk to diplomats and foreign service people, and here in DC, we've got the lack of foreign service and diplomatic people who are doing it professionally. In fact, some of our mentors are foreign service officers. It's striking how much they are interested, in fact, encourage citizen diplomacy. You might think that they don't want it, because then it impinges on their work. But oftentimes they're trying to encourage citizen diplomacy because it helps to humanize a nation. And so, given that understanding, they're all about trying to create personal connections between ordinary citizens in their countries. That said, you know, politicians have agendas, and some of those agendas are good ones, but some of those agendas are not good ones. So you can imagine, you know, for instance, with Vladimir Putin in Russia, that he's very interested in engaging in and stimulating citizen diplomacy, but it's in order to put a brave face on or a bright face and to humanize some of his, you know, more cynical ploys. And, you know, you could say the same thing for the United States. The United States has does good in the world and then does bad in the world. And an argument could be made that citizen diplomacy is basically just greenwashing or window dressing darker forms of policy that professionals are trying to obscure. That would be the cynical side. I prefer to think that there needs to be a vibrant citizen diplomacy sector, international citizen diplomacy as part of civil society, a global kind of civil society. And that sector needs to have a clear-eyed relationship with professional diplomacy in the sense that it's fine at times to work with governments to the extent that governments align with the interests of the citizen diplomacy groups. But with that has to come some recognition that with money comes restrictions and being implicated in and dependent on states that may at times do bad and at times do good. And so developing an independent citizen diplomacy sector that's vibrant, that's interconnected across borders, and that has a humanist agenda, which is to say we're trying to make the world a better place for all people on earth, not just a privileged few, that we have our own principles and our agenda, and we work for that tirelessly every day, at least every workday, is really important as a kind of check on power, on professional diplomacy in particular. And so we can be kind of the conscience at our best, the conscience and the accountability towards governments. If you have a vibrant citizen diplomacy sector filled with people who are global citizens, who care about the world, who are engaged, who know what's going on, then they can call out professional diplomacy when it's masquerading as or when it's concealing self-interested venal behavior on the part of, you know, dictators and oligarchies.
We've talked about citizen diplomacy, but through the Family Diplomacy Initiative, you say you want to democratize diplomacy. Can you explain to us what you mean by that?
Democratizing diplomacy does not mean you get rid of professional diplomacy. There are a lot of very good professional diplomats, and there are a lot of very good people in the Foreign Service generally who are trying their best to make the world a better place. I think our simply arguing that it cannot, it should never, it's just like you don't leave power to a privileged few, you should not leave diplomacy to a privileged few, because it's more likely to be abused if it doesn't benefit from sunshine and wider participation. And that's, you know, those are general principles for democracy, period, which is it's not a spectator sport. It is not a something that should be left to a few people. Democracy is the people's enterprise. And so what that means is, to me, in the long term, is that there is a, as I mentioned, a vibrant global civil society composed, among other things, of citizen diplomats, and those citizen diplomats are not just talking across borders, but collaborating to accomplish whatever issues and tasks, whether it be, you know, developing world peace or developing economic ties between countries. But it also means that they're in regular kind of institutionalized dialogue with professional diplomacy and working together to try to create a better world, but with recognition that they have to some extent be separate entities, funded sometimes by governments, but also drawing from independent sources, ideally from ordinary citizens across the world who come to understand the importance of dialogue and collaboration across borders. So the good thing is the citizen diplomacy sector in the world is growing. In fact, as an aside, I recently developed something called the Citizen Diplomacy Research Group, which is composed of academics, professionals, and, you know, citizen diplomats, practitioners who come together every 2 months via Zoom. And talk about what's going on in citizen diplomacy worldwide and present formally on different citizen diplomacy research projects and programs that exist out there in the world.
Great. And so from what countries have you had participants participate in the international mentoring program and the Family Diplomacy Initiative?
The Family Diplomacy Initiative, as I mentioned, started in 2016 with families in the United States, so here in D.C., in San Salvador, in El Salvador, and in Dakar, Senegal, and Jerash, Jordan. And so the first two pilot projects we did involved those four countries. So since 2019, we've scaled up through Facebook. So we had started a Facebook group during those pilot projects, but then we decided to focus on the Facebook group. So we've since expanded to the Family Diplomacy Initiative now has, I think, at least 40 countries represented. So so we're using LinkedIn and Facebook and other means and email to reach out to organizations and individuals across the world to get them involved in the Family Diplomacy Initiative. We're able to create a really global community of families from different countries and different classes and ethnic and racial groups.
That's great.
Just to answer the International Mentoring Program, we started with ambitions to have kids from all across the world mentored by, at least for now, by American-based mentors. That doesn't mean they're all American citizens, but they're just based in DC, actually in the Metro DC area. And so we started off thinking, well, we'll mentor kids abroad through online. And that has been more of a challenge than you could anticipate these challenges, I suppose. One of them is financial. It's simply that some of our families, because we're dealing with lower income families, mm-hmm. can't afford to pay for the internet for these connections. And unfortunately, we have a shoestring budget, so we can't pay for that internet. So there's that problem. And then there's just the problem of connection. So particularly in Africa, at least at this point, internet connection is really spotty. So that's meant that our mentoring program is largely limited to kids here in DC, but we do have some kids in El Salvador and Senegal that we get through nonprofit partners of ours.
Now, when looking at this global perspective and all the people involved, we have to look at particularly in the Middle East, where women face more difficulties with obtaining an education as compared to men. What effect do you think this has on a global perspective and global well-being? And is there a way to fix it?
This exactly underscores the importance of going beyond school walls, because schools can, to some extent, reflect national policies. And if national policies marginalize girls in their educational system, then we need to invest seriously in alternative education for girls until, you know, policies reflect a more kind of just and equal, you know, principles. So that's, I think, our answer to gender inequality is to create free programs so that your income is not an issue, and to create programs that are hopefully engaging and kind of bring people into a broader community that cares about the kids regardless of their sex and gets them learning based on their based in part on their interests.
Going large scale for the last question. So you said that if we had like a vibrant citizen diplomacy sort of community, then they could sort of hold professional diplomacy to account. If we look at accountability, if we viewed sort of international institutions such as the UN and the EU being accountable to their global citizens in providing them peace, do you believe that they're succeeding at this, or do you think that there could be some work done in providing peace for their global citizens? And is there any inequalities in particular that you feel are there?
Yeah, so good question. Because of authoritarian resurgence and America First, I guess this is his term. there's an element of people out there who are critical of United Nations and other intergovernmental bodies like the EU because it undermines their national, they'd see as undermining their national sovereignty. I read that to some extent as national privilege. So they're trying to hoard their benefits. So there's that problem. Then there's also the problem. So in other words, that you know, countries like the United States, some who are major funders for things like the United Nations, sometimes threaten to just pull the plug and say, we're withdrawing our funding. So there's that problem, kind of a financial, political instability. Then there's a problem that, you know, there are sometimes built into these organizations institutional biases towards more powerful countries like the UN Security Council, which has, you know, permanent members that are composed of, you know, some of the wealthiest and most powerful countries who can kind of essentially put a stop to what they don't approve of. So those are kind of institutional problems, and those are not likely to go away. But that said, the EU, intergovernmental institutions like the United Nations and the EU also do a tremendous amount of good, to the extent that they also bring people, for instance, they have, you know, UN's summit on women, they try to bring youth into their processes, so that they're on a daily basis, right, a lot of good, well-meaning, skilled and capable people in these organizations are doing their best, and they're doing oftentimes great work, empowering and bringing together these people in these different sectors. And so, to the extent, and then also focusing on, you know, health, for instance, the World Health Organization and other things, to try to address long term problems. So the SDGs, and other benchmarks that are set by international institutions to try to solve problems, and in the process of trying to solve those problems, bring different stakeholders together to talk to each other and collaborate. That's great, especially if they uphold high standards and they keep those standards and they're transparent. So there are principles to follow, including bringing people together, trying to empower civil society, that are important not just for the development of citizen diplomacy, but for good international governance. We just have to make sure that we have good people in place and that those people are following just and transparent procedures.
Great. I'd like to thank you, Paul, and the whole of Learning Life organization for joining us today. I know Catherine and I greatly enjoyed this conversation and learned a lot. I loved learning about and hearing about the family and citizen diplomacy and why it's important to bring it to the forefront to shine a light on all these inequalities. Again, this is the Peace Production, the Organization for World Peace's podcast. I'm Monica Sager, and I hope you tune in with us for our next episode soon.